This is the Best of the Adam Gold Show podcast, brought to you by Coach Pete at Capital Financial Advisory Group. Visit us at capitalfinancialusa.com. This is the Adam Gold Show.
Winker's trying to get towards Phil Nevin, and the benches are clear. And Justin Upton comes in. And we have chaos. Can't remember the last time we have seen one of these with the Angels and an opposing team, and it's knocked off.
I've often said, if people show you who they are, believe them. And I'll leave it at that.
They're not going to rook us.
This is the Adam Gold Show.
It's the Adam Gold Show. Good afternoon to you. I'm Adam Gold. That is Dennis Cox. That was an interesting over the weekend occurrence. A legit fight.
Is it okay I say
baseball field?
I loved it. Is it bad for me? Is it a poor reflection of me to sit there and say,
yes,
I enjoyed it?
Yes.
Okay. As long as we're all on the same page, because I loved it.
It's fine. Like, I don't want to see that, but I'm okay with it if we get there without people being Neanderthals on a baseball field. The worst thing for baseball is that old school beanball war.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is the dumbest thing in the world.
Oh, I agree.
Right? Because, I mean, at the core of it, you're giving away bases. It's like, that is, for me, fundamentally, as opposed as I am to a sacrifice bunt, mm-hmm, peeing on an out for no reason, for no benefit, it's sort of the same way in the opposite with intentionally hitting somebody. Not to mention that you actually could hurt somebody. It wasn't intentional. Bryce Harper got hit by a pitch.
Yeah, I mean, he could, thumb.
Right, he could be out the rest of the year. So if you don't give a damn to have that on your head, then fine. Right? But that's a reflection of you. The fact that the manager clearly ordered it, like 10 games ain't enough for Phil Nevin.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty clear that he set the whole thing up. Now, both managers in this case are culpable because Scott Servais has a similar mindset to Phil Nevin. But the whole thing's an embarrassment. But yeah, if you're interested in a fight, but it was a legit baseball fight. That was not what we normally see, a bunch of people milling around. And frankly, I didn't see the pitch that buzzed the tower of Mike Trout the game before. So I don't have, was the whole thing, it's never justified, but in the eye for an eye mindset, could you justify going after somebody? They went after two different people because it was the second guy that they hit. That was in the second inning. The first time they went after, was it Jose Fernandez? The rookie, mm-hmm, from Seattle. They threw behind him, which I don't really understand. What are you doing? Anyway, dumb. It's all dumb. But that's how it's the only way we can consume baseball, right?
Yeah.
You know what my favorite baseball thing over the weekend was? Freddie Freeman bawling his eyes out.
Yeah.
Constantly bawling his eyes out in Atlanta. Very emotional return. But good for Freddie Freeman. Got a big hit, I believe, in the final game of the series. Braves and Dodgers, who may have some playoff history coming up. And that's Atlanta's good. And they could track the Mets down and win that division. Because I think the Mets are also good, but you know, if the Mets aren't going to have Max Scherzer and Jacob DeGrom in the rotation, and right now they don't, then Atlanta can absolutely come back and get them. All right, we got a lot of things to do. We are on television. I saw somebody last night who said, I watch you every day on TV. I apologized.
Well, if they're watching today, they can see this hardware that you earned, sir.
This right here.
So congratulations to you.
This is where this gentleman told me that he watches. It's a North Carolina Sportscaster of the Year that I stole from somebody. But it has my name on it, so I stole it from somebody also named Adam Gold.
Oh.
Yeah, so we were out in Winston-Salem last night for that, and that's where, like, I watch you on TV. So we're on TV. So Spectrum, if you're listening in or watching in Raleigh, 1257. You can also get us on the antenna, 34.1, if you are close to the WRAL-TV5 viewing area. Fire, Roku, Android, Apple TV. Get the WRAL Sports Plus app. And hi. All right, let's go.
They're off.
Little breaking news? Should we do that? Football schedule update. The Atlantic Coast Conference has changed the scheduling model for football. So you don't go 6 years without playing a certain school that's in your league. Shocking that it took this long. So it's a 3-5-5 model. So every ACC school will have three schools against which it will play every year. And then there will be five schools in two different packs, if you will. And you'll play those five schools 1 year and then the next year. And then you'll play the other five schools the following year and the year after that, which we could argue maybe they should alternate. But regardless, every 3 years, you will play at least you'll have a game against every other school, at least every 3 years. And that is better than what we have now, which is once every 6 years for those schools who aren't in your division or isn't your permanent partner. All right, so here's the way it shakes out for the locals, for the four schools in the state of North Carolina. For NC State, give me more textile bowls.
Yes.
State and Clemson will meet every year. I'm going to give State fans some props here in a second. State gets Carolina, Duke, and Clemson every year. Carolina gets... What was
Those
that?
Are State fans.
No, actually, here's what's...
They get to play Clemson every year.
Surprisingly, and look, we haven't played it out yet, so maybe that will change. But surprisingly, State fans have been like, yeah, bring it on. All right, I am here for that.
Yeah, false bravado.
Show me your competitive side. Love it. Really do. So good for Dave Doran and his crew. They have elevated to the point where the league wants them to play Clemson every year. This reminds me of when Maryland and Duke were permanent partners. Mm-hmm. They were. Maryland and Duke was. Not Duke and State. Duke and Maryland, you know why? Because that was the game you had to see every year.
Yeah.
Those two schools waged war, and it was awesome. It was great television. Gary Williams, Mike Krzyzewski, the whole
Steve
thing.
Steve Blake days.
Yeah, well, you know what? We should get Julius Hodge to come on and talk about Steve Blake. Although that's Blake against Duke. Look, those were amazing games, and I understood why the league wanted to highlight those, but of course, Maryland and Duke, and nearly the rivalry is, you know, Duke and State or whatever. So we've got Carolina, Virginia going to play in the South's oldest rivalry every year. Carolina will also get Duke and State. Duke will get Carolina, State, and Wake. So Duke will play the rest of the state. Wake Forest, kind of gets shafted here, at least for in-state opponents. You get Duke every year.
Okay.
But then you get Georgia Tech and Virginia Tech. Like, we couldn't get a third. We couldn't. I guess not. It just doesn't work out. Yeah. And that's fine. But again, because you get at least every third year, you get both of them, you know, one or the other, it's all right. Here's the only thing I would have changed. The only thing I would have changed is that I would have done the five school, you know, 1-5 school group in year one, and then next year, the other five school group. And then run it back with the first group of five, and then the other group of
just
five.
Just alternating
I would have alternated the years, but it probably makes it easier for home and homes and all of that to be scheduled and what, but fine.
Sure.
That's just picking nits. But again, the important thing is you'll never go 3 years without playing in conference school. Mm-hmm. All right, then. Still just an 8-game ACC schedule. I think that's important to know. And Notre Dame is still in the mix. And I saw State has Notre Dame on the schedule. And again, proud of you, State fans. And this will make it a lot easier when your best non-conference game is BYU. Just leave that out there. I'm just kidding.
Are you?
Sure. Can we talk about opting in? So, Kyrie Irving's leverage play failed. It did. Irving was trying to convince the Brooklyn Nets to give him a contract extension. He presented the club. He's got 1 year left on a player option of about $36 million. He had he presented the club with a list of six teams to which he would approve a sign and trade. And the Nets were like, go ahead. Find out who wants you and what they want in exchange for you, and we'll try to accommodate. Oh, isn't it great when they call your bluff? So that took, 6 hours.
Whoops.
And Kyrie Irving decided to opt in. Bobby Marks, ESPN's NBA front office insider on why.
Hey, anytime a player returns and you can't work out an agreement as far as what Brooklyn was looking to do and what Irving was looking to do, and he's on the last year of his contract, an expiring contract. He can become a free agent next offseason. I think that always kind of, the trade question will always linger out there for him. I think certainly you'd love to see what this roster looks like come October if Ben Simmons is healthy and you have Durant on this team. So I just thought it was a business decision that he saw what the landscape of this market was and figured, you know what? The risk of becoming a free agent at the end of the week was just too high.
If Kyrie Irving were a reliable player, the Nets would have already re-signed him to a max deal. Mm-hmm. And if they decided, or if he decided that he wanted to be elsewhere, they would have engineered a sign and trade because the suitors would have been lining up. He is simply one of the most talented players we have ever seen. But sometimes it ain't worth it, and that is the problem. Now, what Bobby Marks said there is important because there still will be a market for Kyrie if he gets off to a good start, if he is determined to be healthy both physically and emotionally. And because of that, Brian Windhorst of ESPN is like, yeah, this ain't over.
In the wake of the agreement, I kind of thought it might have been I don't want to call it a win for the Nets because I don't think there's any winners here, but I think it turned down the heat and at least kept the Nets with two star players with all of their options for next year alive. And boy, was that not what some people, agents and executives that I talked to thought. They don't think this is over.
Oh, no. It's not over. Sean Marks, who runs the Nets, is the GM, I guess, said we can still trade him. I mean, like, the Nets are the big winner here because all their options are still open. And if they do keep him, I'm not going to say that $36 million or whatever the number is cheap, but, for a max player, $36 million is kind of cheap. And that's what Kyrie is going to be, right?
A lot cheaper than what the Lakers are going to pay Russell Westbrook this upcoming season.
That is the other opt-in.
Yeah.
Shocking. Russell Westbrook didn't feel like he would have gotten $47 million on the open market, so he opted in on the one year remaining on his deal, $47.1 million. I don't want to short shrift the additional $100,000. Gosh, that's a lot of money to not be great at this. Just not the same. He's just not the same, and it's unfortunate. Back in the day, it might have worked out, but not working out as is. Adam Gold in studio with my man, Coach Pete DeRuyta with the Capital Financial Advisory Group. We are talking retirement. Coach, let's say I have more than $1 million balance in my 401k.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. How can that actually come back and bite me?
Well, because, and this is a thing that we it's a mirage. You see mirages. I've ridden in the desert before. You see what's water ahead, but it's not there. Well, your financial mirage is thinking that that total balance in your 401k or your IRA is yours. We have two people that want to get a hold of it, two uncles, Uncle North Carolina and Uncle Sam.
Right.
Both of them are going to do some damage to that balance. Depending on what kind of other income you have, you could lose 40% of your value. So if you're looking at $1 million IRA, maybe it's only worth $600,000 to you. So how do we get around this? Well, you don't get around it because you end up in jail if you try to do that.
But you
can do tax planning to minimize the effect of taxation into the future. The tax train is coming, Adam. We need to make sure to minimize the effect of the derailment of our financial accounts. And for the next 10 people, we'll do it at no cost or obligation. Put together your very own tax and retirement plan.
800-661-7383 or text Adam to 21000 for Coach Pete DeRuyta. Speaking of something that didn't work out, yesterday the Hockey Hall of Fame screwed up again. They did not elect Rod Brind'Amour to the Hall of Fame. They elected some wonderful, wonderful hockey players, none of whom were better than Rod Brind'Amour, but we'll get to that. With the authority, a Hall of Famer himself, Chuck Caton, voice of hockey. I appreciate your time, sir. Is it true that 1,484 games, 1,184 points, 9 times a 25 or more goal scorer, 6 times a 70-point or more contributor, 2 times Selke Award winner, Stanley Cup champion, captain of that team, should have been Conn Smythe, was not good enough to get in the Hall of Fame?
Oh, I'll tell you what, Adam, I am just flabbergasted here and very disappointed. And I'll throw some other stats at you right now. You've really done your homework, but here I've got some more things for our listeners. In 7 game sevens in Stanley Cup finals since 1998, nobody has played more minutes than Rod Brind'Amour. Do you realize that? All right, I'll give you another one. Of 44 players with 50 or more points playing 14 or more seasons, and by the way, Ron Francis is number one on this list.
Uh-huh.
All but Rod Brind'Amour are or will be projected into the Hockey Hall of Fame. He's number one in all-time faceoff percentage in regular season play.
Right.
And number three all-time in playoff faceoff percentage. And they started keeping those stats in 1998.
Right.
And to add to what you were saying with all the other accolades, 7 times he represented his country of Canada in different world stages, from the World Juniors to the World Championships to the Olympics. I mean, I just don't understand this, Adam, how he didn't get and I know he was nominated, and I know that the person who nominated him on the committee is a very dear friend of mine, and I certainly obviously didn't have any influence on this at all. But he thinks like we do and like a lot of Hurricane fans do, that he justifiably should have been named, not even this year. It should have been even done in previous years.
I had a conversation. Chuck Caton is joining us here on the Adam Gold Show. I had a conversation. It was either, I think it was last year, it might have been 2 years ago, when Jim Rutherford went in. And I text, and you're close with Jim, I'm close with Jim. And I texted him, I'm like, how is he not in yet? And Jim assured me, be patient, he will get in. And I texted him yesterday. I said, what are your thoughts? Do you think he'll get in? He says, I am optimistic that he will get in this time. Apparently, none of our optimism will work. My question is, if Guy Carboneau is in the Hall of Fame with 663 points, basically a point every other game for his career, and he's in there because of his defensive acumen, and if Patrice Bergeron is referred to as a first ballot Hall of Famer, and I'm not even arguing, how is Rod Brind'Amour not already in? Like, unless Guy Carboneau was, you know, 3 times Ozzie Smith, then there's no way he could be that much better than Rod defensively, to where the fact that Rod has twice as many points doesn't get him in the Hall of Fame.
No, you're absolutely right. That's unfathomable. And I watched Both these gentlemen play. You know, I'm so old that I've seen everybody probably play except Eddie Shore. But anyway, no, Guy Carboneau was a fine two-way player, no doubt about it. But no, there's no way that Rod Brind'Amour takes a back seat to either he or Patrice Bergeron. And I do agree with you that Bergeron will probably be a first ballot Hall of Famer if and when he retires. I hear he's going to probably sign for another year,
yeah.
So it'll be at least 4 years from now. But anyway, this recency bias, I believe, plays into it with the members of the Hall of Fame Selection Committee. I don't know all 18 members, but of course it takes 14 of the 18 to rubber stamp you in. But this recency bias is getting, I think, a little ridiculous here. You know, no due disrespect to Daniel Alfredson, but among this year's potential inductees in November, that's the one I would question in terms of it should be Rod Brind'Amour instead of Daniel Alfredson, in my humble opinion. I mean, Daniel Alfredson never won a Stanley Cup. Never mind character, because I understand that Daniel Alfredson and Rod Brind'Amour are two wonderful off-ice character captains for their team.
Right.
You know, that's probably an even call, right? But to me, you just cited the statistics at the beginning of this interview that just blow people away in terms of Rod's worthiness. And it's just, again, it's mind-boggling. I don't have any answers for you there, Adam, but I certainly concur with you and Mr. Rutherford.
See, here's the thing about the Sedins and Alfredson, and maybe we should change Rod's name to Rod Brind'Amour's son. Give him two S's and make him Swedish because he would get in. I loved all three of those players who got in. I'm not sure the Sedins are first ballot if they're not twins, because I'm not sure either of them are better than Rod anyway. But
maybe
because they're twins and they went 2 and 3 and they played their entire careers in Vancouver, they get in. But let me throw this at you. Is it possible that we're dealing with a Hurricanes pushback, that, you know, how can somebody who's like recognized now for being a Carolina Hurricane be in the Hall of Fame? Is that possible?
I don't think so. I mean, I really don't believe that. I think that he had certainly the makings of a very distinguished career before 2000 when he joined the Hurricanes. With his time in Philadelphia. I mean, after all, he went to the Stanley Cup final as part of that Flyer team that lost to Detroit in 1997. So, I wouldn't think that has – I hope it doesn't have anything to do with it, because if nothing else, he's putting the Carolina Hurricanes further on the map with the way he's coached this team for the last four seasons. And I know that doesn't have anything to do with his playing career, but again, I just shake my head and can't understand why or how much consideration he was given to this distinction. I know he was nominated. I know they talked about him, but I don't know how far it went, and I don't know how heated these closed-door discussions become, Adam, among the 18 members of the Hall of Fame committee.
Man, it's sad, because, look, you and I both know Rod pretty well. I don't think he's not going to lose sleep over it. He's not one that really cares all that much about his own legacy in that regard. But he knows he's good enough. And when you know you're good enough, it can't help but be somewhere in the back of your mind. And he deserves to get in. And I want that for him. He's as good a person as I know in the sport. So he just deserves it.
Yeah, absolutely. I echo all of those sentiments completely. I mean, you can't find a better guy. And I guess the silver lining to this is that, unfortunately, we'll have something to rightfully complain about when it comes to Hall of Fame selections if this continues. I mean, I'm very, very surprised that it has gone this long that we've had to talk about this almost every year, Adam. And I certainly appreciate the opportunity to vent to you and to the listeners.
Thank you very much.
About it. you know, because you're right, Rod Brindamore, well, they don't make him any better than that guy.
All right, we need you on the committee. I need Jim Rutherford on the committee. We need friends of Rod on the committee. Real quick before I let you go, Chuck. Sure. Somebody asked me this, and it's going to be a subject for a podcast in the very near future, and I might even reach out to you to discuss it. What are the next couple of numbers that go in the rafters? We've already got 17, 10, and 2, Rod, Ron Francis, and Glenn Wesley. What are the next couple of numbers? 12 going to go up for Eric Staal, 30 for Cam Ward. Is there another?
Wow, I mean, that's a real good question. I certainly think both those guys deserve to have numbers in the rafters. And then after that, boy, you're putting me on the spot here with thinking about other players that could get that distinction. It's really funny that we talk about, you know, retired numbers. But those two I would have no argument with, and I think further down the line, depending on what happens in the future with the Hurricanes, if they were to somehow possibly win another Stanley Cup under the captaincy of a guy like Jordan Staal,
yeah,
obviously someday you project ahead and you'd like to think number 20 will go into the rafters for Sebastian Aho at some point. But in the near future, I wouldn't have any qualms of seeing 12 and 30 in the rafters, that's for sure.
Chuck Caton, you're the best. I appreciate your time. I will talk to you very soon. A Hall of Famer in his own right and well-deserved for you. Talk to you down the road.
Thank you, Adam. I appreciate it. Take care.
I was so mad yesterday. I mean, I knew it was going to happen,
mm-hmm,
but I was mad. So we'll talk more about it. Rod Brindamore will be fine, but he should be in the Hall of Fame.
Over the crossbar and the Hurricanes have won the Stanley Cup!
June 19, 2006, but it all started May 6, 1997 with the announcement that the Hartford Whalers were coming to North Carolina. It's a story of transition, of heartbreak, of figuring it out on the fly. The Canes Corner look at the 25th anniversary of the move. Presented by the Aluminum Company of North Carolina. Listen now. Find Canes 25th Anniversary wherever you get your podcasts.
As I said before we went to the break, it's time to find out what's going on with the Washington Commandos. I will never call them the Commanders. And it's funny, at profootballreference.com, which is a great website for just for raw data, they still list the team as the Washington football team, as they should have stayed. Grant Paulson from 106.7 The Fan in D.C. You can follow him on Twitter at Grant H. Paulson. I'm sorry, even if I were in your position, I would never call them the Commanders. They would always be the Commandos. It probably has something to do with the owner.
It probably does, I would say. What's up, Adam? Yeah, it's interesting because I think a lot of fans have various emotions and feelings about this. I mean, some people still call them the Redskins, and some people, I'm sure, will stick with Washington football team. Very few people have any identification to or interest in or care for the Commanders yet, but if they win, I'm sure then that'll take hold at some point. My stance has kind of always been I call them whatever they're named.
Right. So, that's,
you know,
fair.
A lot of people started referring to them as Washington when they were the then Redskins. I would still call them that, and people would be upset that I wasn't doing the, you know, the Peter King thing where I stopped saying the word. And my point was, I'm not here to advocate for anything. I'm just talking about a football team, and that's their name right now. So I'm calling them the Commanders. It's really weird, and it sounds odd, and I still have to think about it twice before I say it every time. But that is the least of their concerns right now, is their name, I would say.
There's no question about it. Two playoff wins in the 23 years of the Dan Snyder era. And I know that there are very few people, if any, who are pro-owner in many places. But Washington used to be, I mean, their owner, Jack Kent Cook, was beloved. I mean, he was, they loved Jack Kent Cook in the D.C. area. I mean, I didn't grow up there, but I went to school there and lived there for 10 years. I mean, I knew what Jack Kent Cook and that franchise was all about. It's a heritage franchise. It's become somewhat embarrassing, not somewhat, very embarrassing for the NFL. You just ask the fans, essentially, why? Why do you remain a fan of this team? What was the reaction to that?
Well, it was pretty fascinating, honestly, because, you know, my answer to that, and now in the media, you kind of wear a different hat. I don't know that I would consult, you know, I'm not a traditional fan per se. We can wear different hats on different days, I guess. But you know, I have memories of my mom sitting me on her lap on Sunday, which was, you know, Redskins Day at that time, and watching games in the early to mid 90s. My earliest memories of the team, I'm 34, are after they were good. So this is right. When they went 3-13 and basically the 30 plus years now of ineptitude and mediocrity, and they've won one playoff game now in the 2000s, essentially. So that's, if you're my age, think about that, like mid 30s or younger, that's what you know this team to be. And as you said, they were a pillar. They were a landmark organization. They were one of the great teams in the National Football League and organizations that was the envy of the sport in the mid to late 80s and early 90s. And you just don't have any file on that if you're younger. Most people say it's, you know, they like sports and they like their local teams and that's the end of it, or the memories that they have of going to parades, or that it meant something, that, you know, that rapport, that nostalgia, the relationship with a parent or a grandparent who passed down the love of the team is kind of what keeps them coming back to the well. But I mean, universally, what we kind of came to was none of the reason that anyone supports this team is earned by the team. They're right. Just kind of lucky to have this juggernaut that is an NFL organization, this billion-dollar entity that's a drug that people are hooked on, that they need in their veins. And so they keep coming back to the well and asking for more, despite the fact that Dan Snyder has completely run this thing into the ground. They were dead last in attendance last year when you look at the percentage of butts and seats metric with the Detroit Lions. You know, just types of things, if you look at the TV numbers locally or just the interest on the airwaves, that you would not have fathomed even 5 or 7 or 8 years ago in the 20 years into them stinking. And a lot of it is not just that they're not good on the football field. It's that the disdain for Dan Snyder just keeps growing.
I was there during the 80s and the Super Bowl titles and the Gibbs era, and again, the end of the Jack Kent Cook era. And I remember this is before, I mean, ESPN was a thing, but we didn't have, you know, 500 channels. And basically every night of the week, every single night of the week, there was at least a 30-minute, sometimes an hour, dedicated show to Washington. Playbook, rewind, you know, cover this. Every single day, home team sports probably had three of them. You're probably too young to even remember home team sports, but it was essentially
I remember it well. Right at the beginning of my memories, it kind of owned the regional coverage on TV in town of not just the then Redskins, but they had the Orioles because the Nats didn't exist. I remember it well.
Yeah, and I mean, I was friends with Tom Davis and Chick Hernandez, a friend of mine now. I mean, he and I went to college together. When they hired Ron Rivera, we're talking with Grant Paulson of The Fan in D.C., when they hired Ron Rivera, I think Ron is a good coach. I don't think Ron is a great coach, but I think Ron is a great man and was exactly what this organization needed, a solid citizen, a face of the franchise, because the owner just can't be at this point. But has Rivera been able to mask the smell of that franchise?
Look, he's made a valiant effort, I would say, but no, I mean, there's nothing that a head coach, and even one like him, who's also the GM and also the president of football operations, there's nothing that they can do if they're not winning to reverse the trend here, frankly. And Rivera hasn't won. They had a division title when they went 7-9 in the worst division in football in his first year, with a really soft schedule and a bunch of backup quarterbacks that they beat that was completely fraudulent. And then they went 7-10 last year. So Rivera himself has had 4 straight losing seasons and 5 out of 6. And while he is beloved, and I really like and appreciate and admire the guy, I think, as you said, he's a terrific human being. And he's had 3 winning seasons in 11 years. I don't think there's another coach in league history that has had 3 winning seasons in 11 years and had a 12th year on their resume, let alone one that's beloved and ranked in the top 10. I mean, you just don't hear anyone say a negative word about Ron Rivera.
Right.
And it's not based on the results, I can tell you that, because they went 15-1 when Cam put him on his shoulders pads and was the MVP of the league. But other than that, again, we're talking about 2 winning seasons out of 10 other years as a coach. So, like, where does that all come from? I think it's because he's a nice guy and he has good relationships in the media and he's, you know, he's a decent human being to deal with, and that's great. And he has largely, I think, helped them culturally because he's a people person who treats people well. And he just does things how they're supposed to be done, which was not the case here for a long, long time. But they have to win. You know, that's how I think that the pendulum swings ultimately. And right now, they could do something smart or well or good or decent with some decorum, and it's still kind of like an eye roll thing, like, oh, you guys are just trying too hard. You know, they make a move, and the Patriots make a move, and everyone loves what the Patriots do and hate the same thing that the Commanders did because they're the Commanders. They're the butt of the jokes. So the only way to fix that, I think, is, frankly, to win. But it hasn't been all great off the field for Rivera either. I mean, he brought a head trainer here who was raided by the DEA and no longer has a job. He hired Jack Del Rio, who he fined for $100,000 last week for a couple weeks ago for saying something wacky. I mean, so, you know, he keeps saying judge us on right now, not before I got here. But I don't know how much he wants us to judge him on right now. I mean, it hasn't been perfect for him either. So it's all this place is a reverse car wash. It's kind of what has been said for a long time. Like, he came in with a really, really nice, clean car. And the goal is always to drive out of the car wash cleaner, and most people don't. And I'm hoping for him that he can swing this thing around, but he's got work to do going into year three.
Before I ask you about the team in a second, and I think there are some good things about this team. How does the Jack Del Rio thing shake out? You alluded to it. He was fined $100,000 by his boss, and the boss is Ron Rivera, the head coach. But for me, the worst part wasn't calling what happened on January 6th a dust-up. It was that he essentially mocked 70% or more of his locker room who were in support of Black Lives Matter, because that, to me, inside the locker room is the much bigger deal than whatever his thoughts are on what happened January 1st of last year.
Yeah, so there's a lot to unpack, obviously, in a fairly short time on that. But essentially, Jack Del Rio has on social media been very active and very opinionated for a long time, and he made the decision to tweet a bunch of hot political takes right before he was stepping up to the podium, which I found fairly egregious anyway. And it was, you know, the one time during the offseason, essentially, where he talks. And I don't know if he wanted to be asked about it or if he just didn't think about it or doesn't care, but Rivera fined him $100,000 basically for being a distraction. Now, I don't condone or agree with what Jack Del Rio said, for the record. I guess my personal opinion doesn't matter. But the precedent of fining an employee for saying something you don't like, $100,000, that's a new one. I mean, that hasn't really happened. So the story here was not only that Jack Del Rio said this thing that most people perceive to be insane, but also I don't mean the specifics of what he said, but you're in Washington, D.C., where lives were lost, where people were personally affected, and you're being utterly insensitive, like, at best, right? I mean, I'm giving you the benefit of the doubt. And then on top of that, now this becomes a multi-week conversation where Ron Rivera makes this big statement and fines you $100,000, and it doesn't come from the team. It comes from Rivera. And the whole thing was just really strange. And it was at the same time as we're talking about Dan Snyder and whether or not he's going to go be investigated by the House Oversight Committee and be grilled by them. And he's got allegations against him personally for allegedly, you know, touching former employees. And then there's 40-plus women who came forward to allege the toxic workplace. And all of this is happening at the same time. And again, I wanted to reiterate, while Ron Rivera is pleading, like, talk about us right now and what we're doing right now. So it's a mess. Yeah. And it's a multi-ring circus, and it just seems to never leave town.
And Dan Snyder's never going to testify. He's never going to step foot on Capitol Hill. I'm positive of that.
Good luck seeing him. I mean, people keep saying, oh, well, they're going to subpoena him.
Yeah, whatever.
Next week.
And honestly, I think he's right about how he's going to fight the subpoena, but that's a different topic of conversation. I'm actually going to have that with somebody else later on. Is Carson Wentz – we'll close on this. Is Carson Wentz the guy?
Are you asking me a football question?
I am.
Am I allowed to talk about football? This is amazing. I haven't done that in weeks. I forgot what football's like. Carson Wentz, is he the guy? Here's what he is. Wentz is an improvement from Taylor Heineke. Wentz is a dramatic upgrade from the QB2, who was their full-time starter last year after Fitzpatrick went down in the first quarter of game one. He will be, I believe, their most talented, probably their best quarterback. It gives them the chance to have the most success on offense that they've had since Kirk Cousins, who last threw for 4,000 yards here in 2017, left. And so I think they've gotten better at the most important position. He is somewhere around a top 20 quarterback in the NFL. He is not elite. He's not going to carry them. They got to surround him with weapons, which they're trying to do. They've got a wide receiver one in McLaurin, and they spent on, you guys know, Curtis Samuel, who was hurt all of last year. They're counting on him to be healthy and productive. They drafted Jahan Dotson in the first round, a wideout from Penn State, who's been tremendous this offseason. They've got a good backfield with Antonio Gibson, and now a thumper they just drafted out of Alabama, who had a good career in the SEC, Brian Robinson, and they've got a great pass catcher in J.D. McKissick. They've got the sixth-rated offensive line, according to PFF, last year, and they added a couple guards to replace their two guards who left, so they think they'll be middle of the pack on the O-line. So I think Wentz will be fine. I don't think he's going to hold them back. The one thing I'll say really quickly for people listening is Washington's schedule is softer than toilet paper. They have arguably the easiest schedule in the NFL this year, and this is a statistical metric versus, you know, just anecdotally saying that. I actually believe they're going to go over their win total, and I think they could even win upwards of 10 games, and I don't think the team's that good. I don't think they'll win in the playoffs or make a deep run. Again, I think they're pretty pedestrian, but I'm telling you, look at the schedule. They open with, like, Jacksonville and Detroit, and that's a nice little foray into what they've got this year in a down division and a down conference. So do not be surprised if they're a 9 or 10-win team, even if it means that they're not a particularly great team.
Cottonell? Charmin?
Great question.
Quilted?
Softer.
Quilted. You go quilted.
All right, we'll do that. I think it's the double, like the two-ply, you know what I mean? The double-coated version.
Have to be.
Yeah,
have to be. Grant Paulson on Twitter, at Grant H. Paulson on, from 106.7 The Fan in D.C. I thank you very much for the time, man. We'll talk soon.
Yeah, my pleasure. Good catching up.
You got it, Grant Paulson.
This is the Adam Gold Show.
Over the crossbar, and the Hurricanes have won the Stanley Cup.
June 19, 2006, but it all started May 6, 1997 with the announcement that the Hartford Whalers were coming to North Carolina. It's a story of transition, of heartbreak, of figuring it out on the fly. The Canes Corner look at the 25th anniversary of the move. Presented by the Aluminum Company of North Carolina. Listen now. Find Canes 25th Anniversary wherever you get your podcasts.